Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last month, Congress approved a free trade agreement with South Korea, the biggest U.S. trade pact since the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect in 1994. The pact was expected to sail through South Korea's parliament, but so far, political opposition has blocked ratification there. South Korea is America's seventh largest trading partner. What might the free trade agreement mean for Ohio? Joining us now is Dr. Han Duck-soo. He was appointed South Korean ambassador to the United States in 2009. Before that, Ambassador Han served as the 38th Prime Minister of the Republic of Korea. Welcome to the show, Ambassador Han.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here.
For our listeners, question. U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown has said that without benchmarks, promises of free trade agreements go nowhere. The latest agreement with South Korea also does not include benchmarks. Are you concerned about those issues and whether our free trade agreements live up to the promises made? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ambassador Han, Congress has passed the free trade agreement with South Korea, but South Korea has not yet reciprocated. What's the holdup?
Well, always at the Congress or National Assembly, there are some members who have a different opinions about trade. For Korea, for the United States, these agreements, Korea-U.S. free trade agreements, is a really win-win agreements, and definitely it will create jobs and growth, and it will showcase the benefits of trade agreements in next 3 to 5 years. But at present, although so many academic research and studies show that it will create 70,000 new jobs in Korea and almost equivalent amount of new jobs in Korea, still they are fearing about negative impacts of trade. So they are in a fierce process of discussions and some complementary measures, how to train the displaced workers and what kind of things can be done for some sectors which will be negatively affected. They are in that process still. They have some remaining issues to be discussed, and of course we will do it quite soon and as soon as possible so that the benefits of these trade agreements can take effect soon.
Part of the opposition to the free trade agreement in South Korea is anti-American, about our military presence, blaming the U.S. financial sector for the global economic meltdown. How serious are those attitudes, and how much do they play into this discussion going on right now?
Well, there are some minor portion of people who always think that big countries always make little small countries suffer. And that kind of some ideological, considerations are there. And also they worry about, of course, some of the negative impacts of this kind of trade agreements. But the numbers are, I think, rather small. When there's a poll in Korea, over 60% of the people agree to these agreements, and the opposition is around 25-30%. But even among that, those 25-30% people, anti-American, emotions are much, much smaller. We can safely understand that kind of issue when we heard that when there's a, in the course of the debates, some of the journalism actually criticized that this small group are anti-American. And they say, flatly rejected, that this is not an issue of anti-Americanism. It's the issue how we can minimize the negative impacts of disagreements. That means most of the Korean people like United States, and they never, any small number of people, wants to be recognized as anti-American. That's the feelings in Korea. So, Pew studies show that Korea is one of the countries who likes United States, number two, after Kenya. So it's an amazing number of supporters for U.S. And they cherish the alliance relationship between the United States and Korea, and we work together.
Dick in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hello, Dick.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking me. The question you asked, should the absence of benchmarks within the treaty affect the treaty? I think that it is quite right not to have benchmarks in a treaty. A treaty, after all, it's an agreement. It's written down, which is good, but it's an agreement between two sovereign nations, and the sovereign nations can reasonably do what they think is best. It's the only way to go honestly about business. But so if the United States, to some degree, doesn't live up to its treaty obligations, then the world, and particularly the Koreans, will notice this and will say to themselves, so that's what they are, and if the United States does do that, then the United States will have to bear the consequences of abrogating that treaty.
Ambassador Han, are people in Korea, are some people looking for the same sorts of benchmarks on Korea's side as some folks like U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown is looking for on the American side?
Well, they are worrying about some possible negative impacts, but not in the form of benchmarks, because in trade performances and in this kind of agreements, it'll be very hard because so many factors are at work. For example, Korea-EU agreements are putting into effect from July 1st, but after that, there's a severe financial problems with Europe, and the economy is slowing down. So definitely, EU's export is increasing, while Korea's export to EU is not increasing as much because there's a, recession in EU. So also in NAFTA, there was a severe financial crisis in Mexico just 2 years after the NAFTA was put into effect. So the overall impacts of this agreement should be seen from what kind of tariffs and non-tariff measures are gone, and what kind of transparency and sophistication of institutions are actually improved. For example, Korea's overall average tariff on U.S. imports are 11.4%, while Korea's export are subject to U.S. tariff of on the average of 3.7%. These trade agreements will eliminate both. So 11% gone, 3% gone.
Either completely eliminate or reduce
complete,
in some
almost
cases?
Completely, okay. Almost completely.
In some cases, it'll just be a reduction?
No, just several items. So that means it will drastically level the playing field for U.S. exporters. That's why $11 billion will increase for U.S. We cannot put the time frame on this because other factors will also affect the economy. But it's clear that it will create jobs in the United States. And investments flow from 2006 from Korea is larger than U.S. investments in Korea, with a ratio of 2 to 1, 3 to 1. Last year, Korean investors are investing $5 billion, while from U.S. To Korea, it was only $2 billion. So there are no offshoring in jobs here, and it will create jobs. But Korea will gain the extreme benefits of consumers. 48 million people will enjoy the low-priced, high-quality agricultural products, including, corn, soybeans, beef, and frozen chickens, and so on. From Ohio.
From Ohio. I was going to say, you're here, so there must be some message that you have for Ohio. To what extent will this impact Ohio?
Definitely, Ohio is quite a trading state. Ohio is the eighth largest trading states among 50 states of the United States. And Korea is among the 10th largest export recipient country of the state of Ohio. And Ohio has a very high-tech industry, as well as very, high-quality agricultural products. Koreans will enjoy both. we will have a very high-tech, you know, the refrigerator compressors, and the also we will have some kind of, you know, equipments for, you know, movie houses that are exported by Gitamer Company in Westerville. And we will also have a very high-tech materials of plastics produced by Hexion Specialty Chemicals in Columbus, and so on. So we will enjoy the high-quality products from Ohio. We will enjoy high-quality products of beef from Ohio, too, and chickens.
Jeff and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. I'd like to welcome the ambassador.
Thank you.
Yes, the U.S. Free Trade Agreement will probably impact the Chebus the most. With Koreans' educational level at 80% of university level, do you think that entrepreneurship should be a larger focus than free trade?
Definitely. I think that in Ohio, you have a very good universities, including Ohio State University, and there's a lot of good people, and good people trained at the universities are coming out. And also for Korea, too, we are enjoying quite an interaction among the universities of Ohio and universities of Korea. For example, in Columbus, city of Columbus was selected as a rapidly growth high-tech city by Forbes, and there's a research institute called Bethel Memorial Institute. Already Korean university called Korea University already have had some kind of a cooperative agreements, and they are jointly are conducting the research on health matters, energy matters, and so on. So there are a lot of areas for cooperations between Ohio and Korea in the future. With these free trade agreements, it will increase dramatically more.
Thank you, Jeff, for that call. Melissa in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
I'm sorry, what was the name?
Melissa, welcome to the show.
Oh, that's me.
Yep.
Hi.
Hi.
I have more of a comment than a question.
Okay.
I actually lived in Korea for 14 months, about 4 years ago. And even then, people were protesting the free trade agreement, at least where I lived. I'm sure the ambassador is very familiar with it. I lived on Jeju-do, on Jeju Island. When you look at Korea on a map, it's the island that's at the furthest south point, the most southern point of Korea. And it's because of the fact that it's an island and the fact that it is removed from the mainland of Korea, it is a little bit more culturally isolated from places like Seoul, which are in the north, and Busan and other centers that are much bigger cities that have already been very westernized and industrialized and modernized. Jeju is still, I think, one of the remaining places in Korea where people have retained a lot of their culture. They still wear traditional clothing. They're very agriculturally minded, lots of farming. They supply oranges to most of Korea. And they were very, very concerned. All of my friends and Korean neighbors, very concerned about free trade because they view it as a loss of their culture. I think just since the Korean War, Korea has changed so much, so quickly, and they see that loss of culture coming with their children. And so they saw it so quickly. You know, in 50 years, their culture has gone from, you know, a farming community to something that is much more westernized. And they view this free trade agreement as a danger to their culture.
Melissa, I want to give the ambassador a chance to respond because we're running out of time, but we appreciate your call. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the wonderful recognition of Jeju. Yes, Jeju is a very beautiful island with a lot of traditions and cultures. That's why quite recently, 1 week ago, Jeju Island was chosen by UNESCO of UN as one of the seven wonders in the world. So a lot of investments will be made in maintaining and keeping the cultures of Jeju-do. And Jeju-do is also, you know, designated as an island of education. So a lot of educational facilities will be there. Free trade agreements and growth of the economy will cause more interactions among people. The reason, the fact that more people are coming to Jeju-do to enjoy their culture, their sceneries and beauties of Jeju-do, I don't think that does not mean that the original cultures of Jeju-do will be gone. We will keep that because that's the peculiarity of Jeju-do, and that's the main, you know, purpose of UNESCO designating Jeju as one of the seven wonders in the world. So more interactions will develop Jeju-do, keeping their culture, their people, and their beauties. And I think that this FTA will work in a positive way. But thank you for your some of the, you know, legitimate concerns, as is the case with some of the countries and some of the regions, that too rapid developments will actually eliminate the very good points of beauty and cultures away.
Ambassador Han, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Korean Ambassador Han Duck-soo is in town today. Coming up, world hunger. An estimated 925 million people in the world are hungry. We'll hear from one group working to feed the world by 2050. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Pesca. Coming up on the next On Point, are members of Congress using inside info to get rich? We'll talk dirty politics and big money with a panel including former super lobbyist Jack Abramoff. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins this afternoon at 1 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher today. 38 degrees with some sunshine in downtown Columbus, warming up to a high of only 43 today. Clear skies tonight and cold, a low of 25 degrees. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 47.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, celebrating the season with Home for the Holidays. Vocalist Helen Welch joins the CJO in this annual tradition of holiday favorites, November 30th through December 4th at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
One in seven people in the world goes to bed hungry every night, not because there isn't enough food to go around, but because they don't have access to it or to resources like fertile land and water. Gawain Kripke is the Director of Policy and Research at Oxfam America. Mr. Kripke is a frequent commentator on humanitarian issues and agricultural policies and served as senior policy advisor on Oxfam's Make Fair Trade campaign. He's going to talk to us now about the world hunger issue and what Oxfam is doing to help. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Gawain Kripke is speaking today on global food security at the Columbus Council on World Affairs signature luncheon at WOSU at COSI. Seats are still available. For more information, go to columbusworldaffairs.org. Gawain, the world's population is expected to reach 9 billion by 2050. So we're not talking about feeding all the world as it stands today. We're talking about feeding it with a couple billion more people in it. How will our lifestyles in the West have to change to meet that demand for food by then?
Well, I think that's one of the really big questions in front of us is how do we meet the challenges we face? We have these very big global challenges, world population growing to 9 billion by 2050. The best estimate that's out there is that we probably need to increase food production globally by 70% in order to meet that population growth and consumption growth, which is a really massive technical challenge, how to increase food production. But even as we increase food production, we recognize that that doesn't actually solve the problem of hunger, because right now we produce enough food. So even increasing production doesn't necessarily resolve the issue of people not having or not being able to access food to eat. And then there are all these equity questions about we have an obesity problem in this country while 1 in 7 people don't have enough food to eat in other countries. And we need to take actions to address our own consumption and then also make sure that the distribution or access to food is available in poorer places.
How do you change issues, though, like fertile land and water?
Yeah, it's not easy. It requires investment and strategies. And agriculture as an area of investment and attention has really dissipated in the last 30 years. That was partly because we were in a real supply glut. We had too much food and we had too much agricultural supply, at least in this country, and they were looking for ways of disposing it. So nobody wanted to invest in a surplus production area. That seems to have changed.
Meaning they didn't want to invest in growing it elsewhere as long as we were providing enough here.
Yeah, and okay. Also in terms of research and R&D,
right.
Why invest in increased productivity in something that's already in surplus? So there was a real neglect from both the public sector and the private sector in agriculture for decades because it just didn't look like a profitable place to invest. More recently, we're seeing food prices really skyrocket around the world and sometimes go into really crazy spirals upward, and that's causing big problems, especially for poor people. So suddenly the tables have turned, and we're not ready for it. Our agricultural productivity has not been growing very fast in the last several decades. It's been declining. The rate of increase has been declining, and it hasn't been keeping pace with demand. So we really need to reinvest in new technologies, but also make sure that those technologies are usable by small farmers and by poor people who can't use the most high-tech and most mechanized technologies. So those are really important. And we also have to recognize new challenges like climate change. We can't treat the world as a static entity right now. The world is changing, the weather is changing, and we need to get ready for it.
To what extent is the cost of transportation, in other words, fuel and energy, going to affect our ability to feed the world in the years to come?
Energy has a really complex relationship with agriculture. Obviously, for food, a lot of it is transported, and so you need to use energy to transport it. You also use energy in the production of food in agricultural practices, and then some forms of energy actually use as an input into for fertilizer. So that's all clear on the sort of push side, why higher energy prices push food prices up. There's also a pull side, which is in recent years we've been using basically food as energy. And we've been converting a lot of our corn harvest into fuel for our cars. So now there's a pull as well. So when fuel prices go up, it pulls food out of food markets and into energy markets, and that makes food prices go up. So we have a really complex relationship where food prices and energy prices are increasingly tied together. And that's really bad news for poor people who don't use much energy, have very energy-intensive agriculture, but do have to pay for food and pay for the higher prices.
My guest is Gwen Kripke. He's Director of Policy and Research for Oxfam America. If you have a question or comment for him, we welcome them. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Post your question or comment there. Bioengineering of food is a big deal now. It's happening everywhere. To what extent could that affect the food, our ability to feed the world in the years to come? Some futurists think not so good because we're reducing the kinds of food we create, and that's going to affect, the ability down the road.
Yeah. It's a raging debate about biotechnology and it's hard not to get caught up in it. There are really strong arguments on, I think, both sides, or all sides, I should say, of the issue. And for Oxfam, we can't say that there is no potential in biotechnology. But what we do say is that we need to test it out, and we need to be very careful about it. And that the technologies that work in this country, there's a lot of biotech being used, and it seems to be pretty successful for farmers. In any case, farmers are using it. But that same technology doesn't translate necessarily into really poor countries or for poor farmers. There's a whole package of support and institutions that are needed to make technologies work, and those are often really absent in poor countries in Africa or South Asia. And so we can't just take a seed from Ohio and drop it into Africa and hope it's going to work.
food prices, what effect do they have on politics, and then what effect does politics and possible political instability have on food? We know that in the countries where there are civil wars going on and war, of course, there's always a food problem, but just in general, instability, what does that have to do with the food supply?
Well, most analysts have been looking at this issue from the question of whether high food prices cause political and social instability. And they've done some pretty careful analysis now that does show that there is a correlation, that when food prices go up, and maybe this is kind of intuitively obvious, but when food prices go up, consumers get upset. And in places where consumers are on a knife's edge, where they can't afford to pay higher prices, that creates social instability. In 2007 and 8, when there was a real jump up in food prices around the world, we saw civil disturbances, food riots in more than 30 countries. And at least in two countries, there was a fall in the government as a result of the political instability. So there seems to be something to it, that food prices can help drive political instability for the positive or negative. In the case of the Arab Spring, higher food prices and energy prices were definitely one of the complaints that people had and maybe helped drive a positive political change. But in any case, it is a destabilizing factor, and it's something to be concerned about. And it's one reason why we're seeing our national security agencies beginning to pay attention to food prices, because they want to understand what it means for political instability and whether there are things they should be doing to prevent food price jumps and so forth.
The Oxfam website says that the real problem is not that we don't have enough food in the world, but that poor people don't have access to the resources like the fertile land and water, as we mentioned earlier. How do you know that? How do you measure something like that?
Well, there's very good analysis about famine in the past. And one of the sad truths is that famine is rarely about food. It's more usually about politics or power. And so in many places in historically where there's been famine, for example, there's been enough food, but the food actually left the country. And so there's been good historical analysis of this. And Nobel Prize winning economist Amartya Sen really showed this, that famine is fundamentally the product of a political phenomenon rather than an agricultural phenomenon or a lack of food. And so not to get too technical about it, but we recognize that we can't really address the issue of hunger going forward without addressing the issue of politics and power, and that we'll have continuing hunger. We have hunger today, and we can't solve it by just increasing our production of food. Poor people need rights. They need fundamental access to human rights, but also to the basic tools of survival and economic livelihoods. And those have to be provided to them by those responsible, the governments and companies and private sector. And when they're denied that, then they faced really extreme circumstances.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gwen Kripke. He's Director of Policy and Research for Oxfam America. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We are used to famine alerts and other humanitarian emergencies, and particularly used to responding to them in the United States, the earthquake in Haiti, the floods in Pakistan. How are international relief agencies and non-governmental agencies like Oxfam responding to those emergencies, or is that not necessarily part of what you do?
Oh, it is. It's a core part of what Oxfam does. That's sort of how we got started in this business, is responding to food crises around the world. And we do a good job of it, but we also recognize that these problems are likely to get worse with climate change and the fact that agricultural productivity is not keeping pace with the demand for food around the world. We're seeing the food prices go up and down. So we're really trying to look at structural responses rather than constantly responding to crises. That's a business that we want to get out of. We want to get into the prevention business, and that's going to require political change and pretty big policy change as well. And I mentioned some of the issues like biofuels policy, which is driving a lot of food out of food markets and into energy markets. That's driving food prices up globally. We're looking at the financialization of a lot of agriculture. So there's huge new investors and index funds moving money into agricultural futures, which seems to be creating volatility in food prices, for example. So we think that there are some structural, economic, and political issues that need to be dealt with that would help solve the problem. And then we also need to create a better humanitarian system. We can't treat these crises one by one as they come along. We have to treat them more systemically and make sure the resources are provided for in advance.
Gene, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. My question is, you've not been talking very much about the importance of private property rights and the rule of law. And it's very difficult for a farmer to go ahead and make long-term investments on his piece of land if he does not have a adequate property rights to it and knows that at any point in time the government come along and take it. And you may want to comment on the difference between practical terms between Haiti and Dominican Republic, where Haiti is by any means a basket case. They can't feed themselves, they can't grow themselves, and Dominican Republic, which, while not perfect, does have a semblance of rule of law and private property rights, so therefore farmers can invest in their property, and you've not brought that up to this point.
Well, I haven't brought it up, but it's a valid point, which is that any economic entity, any small business, which farmers are small businesses, need to have some amount of rule of law and transparency and security in their transactions in order to work well. So it's absolutely true that that kind of environment is critical. We don't prejudge the actual legal system that works. There are many different systems that seem to work well, and in some cases there's some ambiguity about it, and that ambiguity can actually serve some purposes. For example, poor people who don't have any access to land can sometimes use unused land without rights, but make a livelihood off of it. We've actually done some analysis in Haiti, for example, to see that the ambiguity in the land law there actually probably helps poor people make a livelihood because they can sit on land that they don't own, but actually grow some crops and make some money. So it's a little bit more complicated than just saying private property rights are an unalloyed good or bad. But you're right that the transparency of the system can really help, and some semblance of security is really important as well. So those are I don't mean to ignore them, and I agree that they're pretty important for small producers.
Thank you, Gene, for that call. We're going to continue our conversation with Goin Kripke, Director of Policy and Research at Oxfam America. So if you have questions or comments for him about world hunger, that's what we're talking about, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
And Friday night on WOSU-TV, the PBS Arts Fall Festival continues from Cleveland with Women Who Rock. The show delves into the talent required by women rockers to make it to the top, and the program tells the history of great American females whose work not only brought down the house, but broke down barriers. Watch PBS Arts from Cleveland, Women Who Rock, Friday night at 9 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, we'll have a discussion of the winter weather forecast, what's in store for Central Ohio with NBC4 meteorologist Marshall McPeak. And then joining us, Columbus Mayor Michael Coleman will discuss the new curbside recycling program for Columbus. Join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher from 11 till noon. Expect some sunshine today, a high of 43 degrees, clear skies tonight and a low of 25, sunny for Friday and a high of 47. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about meeting the challenges of global food security in the 21st century. Still with us is Goin Kripke, the Director of Policy and Research at Oxfam America. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And Vince in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Vince.
Hi, Ann. I'll pose my question to Mr. Kripke, then I'll listen. I was wondering if he and Oxfam has a view regarding the possible role of the Western predilection for meat consumption and the increasing meat consumption in developing countries. In effect, does it take other food off the table since it's so expensive in many ways to produce? Thank you.
Thank you, Vince.
Yeah, thanks for the question. It's a really important issue, and to be perfectly candid about it, it's not something we've totally figured out. In rich countries, there's a preference for eating high protein, more packaged and more produced food. That includes meat products, which do take a lot more resources to produce, both water and energy and grain itself. So it's clear there's a multiplier effect, increasing consumption from our preference for meat. And now we see that in many developing countries, that preference is also emerging. As they get more money, people want to eat higher up the food chain, eat higher protein and higher fat foods. And in many ways, that's a good thing. And we're in no position to tell them what they shouldn't or can't do that. But I think there is something that in the sooner or later, we're going to have to come to terms with whether this is sustainable and whether we can keep consuming at these levels in the North, and whether we can do things that might help developing countries meet their needs without going into the same consumption patterns, which are very unhealthful in our country.
Let's talk about some innovative approaches to food aid, which could have long-term benefits. And one of them is vouchers. Tell us how vouchers might work and, you know, what the benefit is.
Well, food aid is this critical lifeline for people who are really in extreme circumstances, where it's needed in some places where there's no food available. In refugee camps, for example, where there just isn't any food, or sometimes where there's droughts and you need to truck in some food. But very often, food markets are actually working, and it's only because of people's incomes that they can't access food. Maybe the harvest dried up, but you could still buy food if you had money for it. And in those circumstances, it makes more sense to give people money or food vouchers so that they can buy food rather than actually giving them food. That helps actually keep the markets working and helps encourage the local economy, and is a lot cheaper than actually shipping food across the oceans. So we've been really advocating and experimenting with using different ways of providing food assistance, basically not providing food but providing cash or vouchers for food for people who need it. And it's been pretty successful. And the savings is quite large if you can make it work. And we estimate that you can probably save about 50% of the cost of a food aid program if you can avoid actually having to buy it here and ship it overseas. So that means you have a lot more money available to provide assistance if you do it that way. You can't use it all the time, but we could probably use it a lot more than we do. Current law requires that U.S. food aid be delivered as food, and that's really expensive.
So why is that?
It's just the way the law was written. And it's partly a legacy of our food aid program coming out of our Farm Bill. So it's meant to support U.S. farmers, and it's meant to dispose of surplus stocks. In the 50s, we had big government stocks of food that they were trying to dispose of, and that's why the program emerged this way. But it doesn't make any sense anymore, because now they have to actually go out and buy the food on markets and compete with other consumers in order to send it to other countries. And it's very costly, and it doesn't really make any sense anymore.
You know, when you're talking about vouchers, it reminds me of the food stamp program, which is a food card program in the United States now. And yet we still have food banks, and they're growing every day in the demand. So are you thinking of some kind of complementary thing where you have the vouchers, but there's also going to be food shipped in? How would you get those out there and get them to the people? And when you start talking about that, it becomes a currency as well.
Yeah.
I mean, in currency smacks of corruption usually.
Yeah. So, right. I mean, in this country, we made the decision many, many decades ago to switch towards vouchers or cash substitutes rather than actually delivering food to people. We do still have food banks, and they serve certain purposes, but the vast majority of assistance comes in the form of basically a voucher. And it makes sense. It's economical. And it's more empowering to the people themselves. And that's how we see it in developing countries as well. It provides more options and more choice and helps the local economy. So, but it does have to be complemented. And there are cases where there's a preference for actual food delivery, or it makes there isn't enough food in local markets in order to provide it. So it makes sense to have both options available, but to be moving towards cash or vouchers as the option. The issue of corruption is real, and a lot of people, when they hear about it, think it doesn't it would get corrupt. But our actual experience with it is that there's no reason that that cash or vouchers is more susceptible to corruption than actual food. You see a fair amount of food aid actually get diverted and never get delivered where it's supposed to go, and food bags of food can be sold just as easily as cash can be or vouchers can be used. So maybe not just as easily, but pretty easily. So and the experience, I mean, so far in the audits, there just isn't that much corruption that's emerged. Certainly not. Apparently more
in voucher systems,
in voucher and cash systems. So we're tentatively positive about it. We're worried about it, and also there's a high level of skepticism among the public about the American, you know, taxpayers about sending cash. But the evidence so far is pretty good that it's not more susceptible to corruption.
Email from James. He says, regarding the statistics on people going hungry at night, how many or what percent are due to food being used as a weapon? I've traveled extensively in sub-Saharan Africa, both east and west, and have seen deprivation and starvation resulting from state-sponsored activity.
Well, I think you put your finger on it. A lot of food insecurity, a lot of hunger is the result of politics. And the people who tend to go hungry are often people who are at odds in some way with the government, or they're in conflict situations. And I mean, that's what we're seeing in Somalia. Somalia is facing an actual famine right now, where people are literally dying because they don't have enough food. And Somalia is effectively a failed state that has ineffective governance and is in conflict. That's the result of a failure of politics. So there has to be a political solution to hunger. It means that we have to have more effective governments, more responsive governments, more ways of solving conflict that don't involve conflict, and in which food is not denied people because of politics or ethnicity or social class.
An email from Robert. To have food production increase in the face of climate change, what are the main ways that this production needs to adapt to this change and also to mitigate the amount of climate change?
Great question, and actually there's a lot in that question. So agriculture produces a lot of climate change emissions. By tearing up the ground, you actually release a lot of carbon into the air. And so it's many observers think that agriculture can play a big role in solving the problem of climate change. So there's some potential in that, we think, in making farmers actually agents of climate change prevention. But in the meantime, we know that farmers are going to face changes to the atmosphere or to the weather in this country, and especially in developing countries. The best modeling shows that countries sort of around the equator are going to face a lot more climate variability going forward. And those farmers are very poor and usually don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with it. They don't have irrigated land systems or agriculture systems, for example. So they depend on the weather, and if the rain doesn't come, they don't have a harvest. So we really need to make investments to improve their livelihoods, to create new agriculture strategies that can deal with higher weather variability, more floods, more droughts, shorter growing seasons, more tolerance to standing water, for example. These are things that we can do, but if we don't make the investments, it's not going to happen. And if we don't pay attention to the particular situations that farmers are facing in these countries, if we keep developing strategies for farmers in Iowa, for example, we're going to miss out on helping farmers in sub-Saharan Africa.
My guest is Gwen Kripke. He's Director of Policy and Research at Oxfam America. If you have a question or comment for him, we welcome him. You can go to the email route, allside@wosu.org. You can also call us at 614-292-8513. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We were talking about vouchers earlier. What about cash for work programs? And how do those are a step beyond a voucher. They're asking you to do something for it.
Yeah, there's some some of these things are versions of each other or interchangeable. Sometimes you provide vouchers just as an unconditional benefit in really extreme situations. Sometimes you create food for work, cash for work, vouchers for work programs where you ask people to contribute labor in order to receive the benefit. And then that labor can be used to do useful things like clear out irrigation channels or help maintain roads that help the community and actually maybe build resilience to future problems. So these are all different strategies to provide assistance, but also try to create some risk reduction in the future. And some of these programs have been enormously successful. And although there aren't problems with them, but we're developing ways of dealing with vulnerability that are helping to prevent famine. In many countries, we're seeing now that could have faced real famine and real loss of life because of food insecurity. Programs like Cash for Work and Food for Work programs are saving lives, and they're in place already so that when emergencies happen, they can be scaled up and used to help people. So it's a real innovation, although we need to do a lot more. They need to be present in a lot more countries that are facing potential challenges. Too often we come into a country that has no infrastructure in place, social infrastructure or physical infrastructure for assistance, and that creates big obstacles to providing assistance and getting people back on their feet.
What about the microfinance model? How would that work with agriculture at a local level? Is it different than, say, giving someone $30 to start an embroidery business?
Yeah, the issue of microcredit is a big one. Many poor farmers don't have access to any credit, or they do, but it's a very restricted way, for instance, only to produce certain kinds of crops, like cotton, for example, or maybe coffee. They can only get credit to produce that, and they can't get credit to produce other kinds of crops. So agriculture is a risky business, and it's sort of understandable that banks and credit agencies are worried about providing credit in that area because crops go bad and they don't get their money back. So providing rural credit, agricultural credit, has been a real challenge, I think, for the microcredit industry. Most of it is really in urban areas and for other kinds of enterprises. And so it's an area that needs a lot more attention. Farmers do need credit. They also need the ability to save effectively and provide their own credit by saving from year to year. And many farmers don't have access to banks or really secure systems of savings. And that includes their own production, where after the harvest, they don't have a safe place to keep their harvest, so they have to sell it immediately. Otherwise, it'll spoil. And that means they get very low prices. If they had the ability to warehouse it or save it for a couple months, they might get a much better price. So these are all tools that can help small farmers have a better livelihood. The credit end of it is an important one. The savings end is really important. The harvest, post-harvest facilities so that they can save more of their harvest and sell it at a better price. These are all strategies. And we really shouldn't focus on only one, like the microcredit side of it, because there may be better benefits to be gotten out of other parts of it.
And to what extent does education play a role in all of this? We know it does with healthcare, with the spread of AIDS. What does it mean in terms of people feeding themselves?
Well, education is a human right. People really deserve, children deserve a basic education. And we've been arguing this, that it's a human right, but it's also a huge economic multiplier. And when people, but especially girls, get access to education, you see incredible benefits economically and in terms of social welfare all over. So we really think education as such is a really important investment, and governments need to invest in it, and donors like the United States need to keep supporting education programs in developing countries. It really helps it. Many farmers are, and rural people in general are very poorly educated. They often aren't numerate. They don't really understand basic arithmetic, and that makes running a business hard. Farmers are businessmen. They need to be able to add things up, understand if things make money. Is it worth it to take out a loan or not? What is the price they need to get in order to make a business? And so basic business skills are often lacking, which means that they're just not well positioned to make money out of their livelihood. So that kind of education is something that we do try to do. We try to work with farmer cooperatives to provide basic tools like numeracy and basic business skills for farmers and for their cooperatives and for their organizations. So we think it's critical. It's a really key piece of it, and it's at least as important as the technologies that people talk about. If you have an innovative seed technology but don't have the education to know how to use it or how to use it as part of your business, then it's not really, really very useful.
When people are listening to this program, they're wondering, well, what can I do to help? What does Oxfam recommend the average American do or think about when in terms of world hunger at this point in the game?
Well, I hate to say this because no one wants to hear it in this day and age, but the assistance we provide, the U.S. government provides with taxpayer support internationally is really important. And so I'm talking about foreign aid. And it's less than 1% of the U.S. budget, but it provides this critical lifeline of assistance to poor farmers and for food assistance for people who are facing hunger. And we really hope that even though the budget is really tight and there's a terrible controversy and war going on Capitol Hill about the budget, that we can save this little piece of the government programs that really helps the poorest people on earth. So no one wants to hear about keeping government programs or spending, but it's really critical to our mission.
A lot of times people have a hard time connecting foreign aid, that very minuscule amount of money, to what how it affects their lives.
Yeah.
And why it's good for them.
Yeah. Well, this investment from the U.S. taxpayers in the well-being of people around the world, and especially for the poorest people, is a long-term investment of goodwill. I mean, ironically, some of the strongest advocates for our foreign aid programs now come out of the Defense Department, who say that providing foreign aid is a lot cheaper than fighting wars, and it's a much more effective and humane way to make sure that peace and stability reign throughout the world. So you can see it as a more effective and cheaper way to provide stability and goodwill around the world for the U.S. But before I leave it, there are a lot of things that we can do in our own lives besides as taxpayers to help the issue. One is to look at our own consumption, which one of the callers brought up, and think about whether there are things we can do to improve our role here. And then to look at our domestic policies, our farm bills, and our energy policy, and see if that can contribute to solutions to hunger.
Gawain Kripke, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. It's been fun.
Gawain Kripke, he's Director of Policy and Research for Oxfam America. He will be speaking today on global food security at the Columbus Council on World Affairs at WOSU at COSI. Go to columbusworldaffairs.org for more information. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.